that beast. All right, we got to go. I'm going to, so this is sort of framing, hopefully, future conversations. Now you have maybe a better idea where I'm coming from. And I'm going to be exploring, you know, how we deal with this stuff here and now locally, and talking about things sort of from that framework. So thank you very much. This has been Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present David Barsamian, Resistance in the Age of Trump, on Sunday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Journalist, author, and activist David Barsamian will be speaking about the broad coalition in opposition to the Trump administration, which includes activists from a range of causes, progressive Democrats, and concerned Republicans. He'll be reflecting on the core issues at stake today and why so many people from such a range of identities and perspectives are challenging the administration. Again, that's KBOO Presents David Barsamian, Resistance in the Age of Trump, on Sunday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you're listening to KBOO Portland. Here's what we have coming up for you this morning. First, it's Politics of Living. Today, a look at a new documentary about legendary Portland animator Will Vinton. It's called Welcome to My Daydream. Plus, local writer, artist, and educator Rachel Rice. At 10 o'clock, we got Air Cascadia. 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock, The Bike Show brings you news and views of cycling in Oregon and beyond. And remember that KBOO keeps you informed, inspired, entertained. And you can be involved by going to kboo.fm, kboo.fm, and click where it says donate to become a member. Thanks in advance for taking care of that. And we go now to the politics of living. It's 9:01.
Hello and welcome to this episode of The Politics of Living. I'm your host, Denise Kowalczyk. This program takes a look at the politics and all that we experience in life, whether it's making a film, to living during these unsettling times, to processing the death of a loved one. Politics are everywhere. On today's show, Darka Dusty returns with a new segment, 10 Minutes with Darka. Kristen Thiel introduces us to two different women with the same name. Liam Delta brings us a vox pop from the streets of downtown Portland. And I share some reflections on a personal experience relating to a family member. But first, Portland has its share of icons in the world of sports, in the world of art, ranging from theater to musicians to even architects. Now, one of those iconic individuals is Will Vinton, who single-handedly turned a creative company he started in his basement into a $35 million organization. Now, two men are leading the charge on a documentary about Vinton's work in the world, and contributor Inessa Anderson recently spoke with the director, Mark Evans, about the project.
And that's really, for me, what it was that interested me in this project. I was finishing up my previous film called The Glamour and the Squalor and looking for my next story, and came across an article about Will and just kind of his rise and unfortunate fall with the company that he had started. But immediately I was just struck by all the characters that I remembered from my childhood, you know, starting with the California Raisins and memories of watching his Claymation Christmas special all through, you know, the PJs a little bit later in the studio's history. So yeah, really, you mentioned the characters, and that's what it was for me that sparked an interest. And then when I realized that there was a really great story of how all this happened, that's where I thought, wow, this could be a really good film. And reached out to Will, and it took a little while. He wasn't super interested in doing a film at first. We hit it off really well, getting coffee face to face, and he wasn't so sure. But he's been ever since he did decide to come on board, he's been really great to work with.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to think about his famous studio there in Northwest Portland. I mean, it was just a stomping and stopping by ground for so many talented people, you know. Can't even begin to think of, you know, I mean, just, I don't know how you're approaching the documentary. We'll talk about that a little bit, but it was, you know, he starting out of his basement and he turning it into, you know, what do you think it was as you've gotten to know him that made him even envision this claymation thing? And, you know, how did that spark for him? Could you?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was a really kind of practical way that it first started and became a thing that he was even involved with. He was in architecture school at Cal Berkeley in college. And coincidentally, a lot of the people that he worked on, especially early on, were architect students that ended up getting into animation. Quite a few of them that were their most successful people. But with Will, he realized that he would get it was always almost an automatic A if he presented his structures in architecture class by shooting it on video. And he would generally build these structures out of clay, and then he would shoot them. And he just realized that was the best way to get an A. was to do it on video. And
note to students.
absolutely, especially now. Yeah. So he had he had his dad's old 16mm camera shipped down, and then he started. This was the time of it was kind of the hippie movement in the Bay Area at the time in the 60s, and so he was documenting a lot of things, really kind of becoming just a filmmaker and a documentarian in his own right. But he had this camera and he had all this clay because of architecture school, and him and some buddies just would start playing around with it and started making little movies, started figuring out how to animate and make these things move. So then it wasn't long after that he graduated from Berkeley. And
what year was that, by the way?
That would have been like the late 60s, early 70s.
Because at the time, video was just sort of nation. I mean, it wasn't really a thing yet, except for those family videos that you see.
Right, and that's, you know, it was his dad's 16mm film camera that he sent down. So all of a sudden, you know, his dad didn't have a camera anymore, but Will did. And so that's really, you know, we kind of talk about like the birth of claymation as we know it, you know, which Will went on to coin and trademark that term claymation a little bit later. But that really started around kind of a kitchen table in at Berkeley when he was filming these things. And then he had this idea. And after college, he had moved back to Portland and was working in film and video and had his own company and worked with another company with documentary and live action type things. And then I've got a garbage truck driving by right now. I'm sorry about that. You probably hear that.
Yeah, I'll just let it pass.
Okay, one second.
Oh my God.
Yeah, they come by way too often. I need to like petition to. Yeah, shoot, he's.
Yeah.
He's,
I
across
do,
the street right now.
Yeah, I do voice work from my home studio, and it's like I had to go out this morning and say to this big giant truck, what are you guys doing?
Like, you know,
7:30, we go to bed at like 2 in the morning, and it's like, oh man. And they're putting in some, anyway, it doesn't matter, but it's really loud and noisy, so it's like, I don't know where to move to get,
you know. Well, honestly, it's this one building that I think they have this truck come by daily, and oftentimes there's nothing even in their garbage can. Uh-huh. But it's enough for me to be like, okay, I need to like move to the woods or somewhere to have some quiet.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway,
so he's kind of sitting out there right now. He's still there, but it's not too loud. Should we keep?
Let's just keep on talking.
Okay.
Sure.
So then he had this idea for the film that ended up being Closed Mondays, and worked with his partner for, you know, he was a partner for a little bit, Bob Gardner, and lo and behold, they end up winning an Oscar for best animated short film, and it was the first clay film ever to, I think, be nominated, and it won. And
so, getting back to the clay for just a quick second, and going to Caltech, was it?
Cal Berkeley.
But the fact that architects have to work with clay, and then a lot of them went into this other thing is kind of interesting, you know?
Yeah, I mean, early on, he was working with Barry Bruce. I can't remember if Barry was an architect student or not, but Don Mert was, and then Joan Gratz, who went on to win an Oscar of her own for her own film. You know, you talked about these amazingly talented people that came out of the studio, and that's really, for me, one of the giant takeaways, is Will was just so good at identifying talent, but then also creating this company that people just wanted to work for. And so he attracted this amazing talent and could put it all together. He could put these talented people together and create a project that everybody was on the same page on and was passionate about, and So that's why they, not only did they have so much success as a studio and Will had so much success, but that you also saw so many of these people go on to do their own great things after they were at Will Vinton Studios. So Craig Bartlett would be a great example of somebody that started at Will Vinton Studios. He was kind of Mr. Noid. And he worked on The Raisins and a lot of those great characters. And then he went on to start his own studio and created shows like Hey Arnold, which was a massive show and still getting a film reboot here. He also did Dinosaur Train, and he's got a newer show, Ready, Jet, Go, that my 7-year-old son watches. So it's and that's just one example of many. I got an email the other day from a guy named Angus McLean, and he was a co-director on Finding Dory and with Pixar. He, again, got his start at Will Vinton Studios. Like he grew up in Portland, and that was just like his mission. Like, I have to work at Will Vinton Studios, and he did, and he got his first break there, and then has had this great career at Pixar. So it's been really cool hearing all the stories. But Will, that was, I think, his best strength is, he would have these ideas, but he could really put them all together and really drew off that wealth of talent that existed and still exists in Portland.
I think that seems to be kind of the pivotal thing. I mean, yes, people can work on their own completely separately, but those that are able to draw in talent, like Will Vinton was able to do and invite that talent in, is phenomenal for the city.
Totally. I think, and I've heard this from a lot of people that I interviewed, that what Will did in creating that studio there's a lot of people today that will give credit and say a huge reason that stop motion animation and animation is so big in Portland has to go back to Will Vinton Studios. But there's been a lot of people I've interviewed that want to take it beyond that and say so much of this creative energy of the city, you have to look back at Will Vinton and then also probably Jim Blashfield. And it really starts there, because they were bringing this work to Portland and doing things on a national scale that hadn't existed before that. So it's really, whether it's the music scene that's in Portland, whatever in the arts, I think a lot of it, it's not like I'm trying to say, it was all because of Will Vinton, but really it was that era where it all started in the city of Portland.
Yeah, very, very, very much so. In fact, it's interesting that you brought up Jim Blashfield, because I hadn't thought of his name in a long time. But when you mention iconic names like Pixar, even those of us who don't work in the industry know Pixar.
Sure.
I mean, most of us do anyway. It's like a household name,
Yeah, there's a pretty funny story. I'm going to save it for the film and not tell it here, but that involves Will.
Aww.
When he was thinking about potentially getting out of the company before it ended up crumbling all around him, he had an opportunity to maybe do something with Pixar, who at the time, they were just getting going. They had just made Toy Story, but Will Vinton Studios was also at the top of its game. So Will ended up looking at this particular deal and deciding not to take it. But had he, things would have turned out quite a bit different.
Yeah. Do you think, just stepping aside from Will Vinton for a second, how important is that kind of thing right now, the animation, if you will, of all these different kinds? It's gone so far from the time when I was a kid, recalling the beauty of Sleeping Beauty or
sure.
Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, the things, that incredible things that were painstakingly done at Disney, it was a whole different world.
I do think that with the computer animated films, I think they're getting so good. And they do feel real. And, obviously you look at the work that Pixar has done and continues to do. And it just, from a practical standpoint of producing films, from a schedule standpoint and a budget standpoint, it obviously makes sense to continue to go that route. But I think there's always going to be this need for the realness and be able to touch these puppets, because you can feel a difference and you can connect, I think, with the characters that are made that are three-dimensional. So you look at what Leica is still doing today, they're still doing stop-motion animation. It's different than what Will Vinton Studios had been doing generally with the clay, or even when they moved on to Foamation with some shows later. What Leica is doing is still just an extension of that. And I'm glad they're doing that. You've got Aardman, who continues to work in the clay animation realm and putting out amazing work that's, everything that they do is Oscar nominated. So I think that there's always going to be a spot for that, but it's But the reality is it is more expensive. It does take longer than using the computers. So I don't think we'll ever come back to a day where it's the norm.
I just wanted to mention that you are introducing two original claymation style characters, Lodge and Randy.
Yeah.
Who I like this idea. Living inside of Will's head and representing his left and right brain as you guys navigate the story. The Welcome to My Daydream. But that's a great title, by the way. That's a really hard thing to come up with, those titles.
Right. Yeah. I got to give Kevin Moyer the producer credit for that. He had come up with that, and we sat with it for a little bit and thought this works, especially as we're developing these original characters. So as you said, like these characters will live inside of Will's head. So Will as our subject and our character that we see throughout the film via either present day interviews or archive footage, behind the scenes footage. We have 9 scenes outlined right now that we're starting to work on that will go inside of Will's head as a live action real person, and inside of his head will live in Will's head will kind of be like an apartment, and we'll live these two characters, Lodge, who is Will's left brain, and Randy, who's his random artistic creative right brain.
And that's the one.
Yep. And as the story unfolds with the documentary, we'll be going back to these characters and see them at that certain point and how they're interacting with each other.
Mark, that just sounds like so much fun.
Yeah.
It's
a ton of fun creating, and if we can pull it off, I really think it's going to be really innovative stuff in a documentary. And so I'm totally excited for it. We're developing the characters right now. I'm working with Tony Merrithew, who had worked for Will and the studio for a long time, and was instrumental in the Raisins and Noid and development of those characters. We're even using some of the old Raisin hands for new characters. So it's pretty cool to be creating something new, but also bringing in some of the past to the actual characters as well. So yeah, it's an exciting thing. We're getting pretty far along in the character development, and hope to announce them officially soon and introduce them and what they're going to look like and all that. And then talking to some folks on the animation side about who we'll work with to produce those, and that'll be something we're hoping to get started on that, on the production of it this winter.
Oh, good. Well, you did have, like you said, you did have some convincing with Will in order to make this film about his life. I mean, it's an intrusion of sorts.
Yeah.
Is he, what's he doing these days? Was he just chilling back? He doesn't have the company anymore. That's gone.
Right. Well, that's definitely not his personality. He is still super active and just loves to create, loves to come up with ideas and try to get them out into the world. So he's still doing everything that he's always done. I mean, it's different when you don't have a studio backing. He's truly back to being an independent, but I think he likes that. And so he's always has numerous projects going on. The one that he spends probably most of his energy on is a musical that he's developing, and hoping, if all goes well, it could be something that they could take to Broadway. So that's really, it combines a lot of what he did in his career with creating characters and adding great music to his childhood going to musicals with his family. So
yeah, when you think about musicals now, I mean Hamilton among them, but but there's so much fodder out there for, who thought that Hamilton would be a killer musical?
Right.
back when those guys began on the idea. I wonder what it was that tipped it to him saying, you know what, come on and intrude in my life. Sure.
Well, that's tough. I mean, I don't know if I could ever, be a subject, be on that other side of the camera, because it is tough. And I think Will is a fairly private person, which is maybe a little bit tough to say that for somebody that's spent most of their life in the public eye. But I think that was it. Like, just how much am I willing to expose about myself personally? And then, Mark's going to go out and interview 30, 40 different people about me. Yeah. And, but I think so for a while it was just that of building trust that I'm going to do this film the right way. And then I think he also, probably is thinking a little bit about just a legacy and not just for himself, but just the work that they created and making sure that that's preserved the right way through a story like this. So, I think it just took a little bit of time for him to live with the idea of having a film out there. And once he could do that, I think he felt more comfortable. And like I said, since then, he's just been awesome. I mean, he's supportive every step of the way and really helpful.
Well, I think that if he looked at your background, the glamour and the squalor you mentioned,
uh-huh.
This is a film about Nirvana.
Well, it's a film about a radio DJ named Marco Collins. So it's another biographical film of somebody from the Northwest. This happened in Seattle. And Marco started at this massive radio station in September of 1991. And really right away is when he had the opportunity to play Nirvana and Pearl Jam, their records. That
What were the call letters?
KNDD, 107.7 The End.
Sure, The End.
Which is still around.
I'm familiar with The End.
And obviously radio is way different today than it was then. You know, radio is what was breaking music. So Marco was this very instrumental and influential DJ that really pressed play on the grunge movement that came out of Seattle. So definitely, you know, some similarities in a way of these individual people. I mean, those are the kind of stories that I think, at least right now, I'm really attracted to, is the kind of the biographical documentary, especially about somebody that maybe outside of that city wasn't as well known. I think Will Denton, clearly in Portland and in the animation world, is well known. But beyond that, people might know the characters, but not necessarily the name or the story and everything that happened. So definitely looking to kind of expose the story to more people and Will's work.
So just quickly, what do you think is next in the future of animation? You know, as me who grew up with the Disney animation stories, and they were so real looking, and then it kind of transcended into something kind of herky-jerky that I wasn't attracted to anymore. And obviously, growing up, I wasn't watching animation very much. I was busy in my own theater life and all that kind of stuff. But where do you see a future? You kind of mentioned that it takes so much work to do the stop-motion animation. It's much quicker on the computer, you know.
Yeah.
But what do you see? Can you sense it at all?
You know, for me, I'd it's a good question. I mean, I think that as costs continue to come down with everything, even in animation with the CGI, I think you have, you know, more independents that are able to get into it, and then you'll have people specializing in certain things. Like, so far, Leica has focused on the stop motion. Maybe they'll do a CGI film at some point, but I love that they're specializing in the stop motion, and same thing with Aardman. But yeah, I think that you'll just see a lot of different options that are out there, and continue to see that as the cost to produce comes down, and you'll see more made for adults, which, you know, I think all of the, you know, Pixar has done so well because they're for kids and adults. Their stories are so good, and I know Will, even, you know, he wanted to make things that wasn't for kids. That was one of the things that even back when he first started in the 70s, it was, you know, animation shouldn't just be for kids.
There's right, something more sophisticated, yes.
Yeah, so I think you'll continue to see more of that, and maybe you'll start seeing a lot more go back to TV as well, too. You know, obviously,
right,
you've got shows
right,
like The Simpsons that have been around
forever.
Oh,
my gosh, The Simpsons are so relevant right now, aren't they?
Yeah, totally. And then, you know what, one of my favorite shows on TV is BoJack Horseman.
I was just going to say to you, my daughter introduced us to that, BoJack, it's so brilliant. It's so grown up.
Yeah.
That is grown-up stuff right there, BoJack.
So I think you'll see more of that, and like I said, see maybe a little bit more of the independence, being able to produce content like you do in other genres, whether it's documentary or narrative. You know, you'll see these lower budget but great stories.
Right.
I think, and there was even a few films that have been coming out the last couple of years like that, feature-length films that have been more independent. So, you know, who knows? I mean, the whole industry has been shaken up over the last 5-10 years, and it'll continue to be. But I think the more access there is for people to create, the better it'll be, because just, you know, less restrictions is good.
So let's end on this Kickstarter thing. Kickstarter can be a wearisome thing for the audience, for
sure,
those out there. It's like, oh no, here comes another GoFundMe thing. And
I get it.
Music is expensive to make. This is a way that we've been doing it now for several years. But there's a weary bone in my body towards Kickstarters. Why did you guys decide Kickstarter for this project?
So, you know, I did a Kickstarter campaign for my last film, and it was successful. But
what kind of money are you looking for? What kind of funding?
So our goal on this one is $35,000.
Okay.
And the one that I did previously was $50,000. We raised $55,000. But after that, I kind of had told myself for a long time, I'm not going to do another one of those campaigns. It was a lot of work, and
you really have to usher it. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's a full time job, not just during the campaign, but also now you did open yourself up to having, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people that do want updates, and that's great, but it's finding the time for that and making sure that you manage that the right way and realize that, okay, your team just grew by quite a bit. It's not 2, 3, 4 people working on this anymore. It's, you know, really, if somebody pledges, you've got to treat them like a team member. And it was, and that first one that I did, it was just a lot. And I thought, oh, I don't know if I want to go through that again. I didn't realize, I just want to create, right? And, but over, we've been working on Welcome to My Daydream now for at least a year and a half, just self-funded and passion project. Whenever we have the time to work on it, we will. Uh-huh. And it kind of got to that point, though, where, okay, we need to bring on some additional funds or it's just not going to get finished, because just working on it whenever we can on our own budget, this thing will take 10 years. So I started thinking more about Kickstarter, and I'm certainly an independent filmmaker. I'm not tied to any studio or anything like that. I work in my garage. And I thought, this is such a great tool, and I have no right to complain about lack of funding or anything like that if I don't take advantage of every tool that's out there.
Right.
And that's when I realized we need to do a campaign and let's connect with an audience. And it's been so awesome. And we launched about 2 weeks ago. We have 17 days left.
Plus the fact that this is the way that people find out about what this is.
Exactly. It's not just about the money. We've reached so many more people that this film exists, this project exists, and it's really been amazing to hear from people, whether it's new people that I'm interviewing or just people that can't wait to see the film when it comes out. So that's been really awesome, and it's been a jolt of energy. And we're off to a good start with the campaign, too. We still have a long ways to go, but I do feel good about it. And I understand that people are weary, especially because there's so many things, whether it's a Kickstarter or GoFundMe or whatever, there's hurricanes around there, you know, there's a lot of very worthy causes for people to help pledge their money towards. So
yeah, and like Amanda Palmer told us, you know, the gift of the ask.
Yeah, exactly. So
she led the way. Yeah.
Yeah, and so we're looking to raise $35,000, and there will need to be more money raised beyond that.
But this is a start.
Yeah, exactly. This will allow us to get the rest of the interviews done, have a rough cut of the film. I'm hoping to be able to storyboard the new claymation scenes with our new characters with this money, and then from there we'll have something really rock solid to be able to take the next steps, whether it's additional financing through investors or, you know, can we pre-sale it based on that rough cut? So that will create some options. So that's
maybe a Kickstarter that will be all about the chance to meet Will or something.
Potentially. Well, we do have one reward on our current Kickstarter, which is a dinner put on by this pop-up restaurant that is really great, and having it at Will Vinton's house. And so Will will be there. I'll be there as well. So yeah, there's already an opportunity to pledge for that.
Well, Mark, it's been great speaking with you. I'm going to have to go back and look at your documentary on the grunge scene explosion from the end.
That would be great.
It's really good to get to know you a little bit, and hope that we can hook up along the way with Kevin. He's a great guy.
Yeah,
I met him through the Elliot Smith documentary.
Yeah, which is a great project. Great
very film. Wonderful project. So this sounds like another one. It was great speaking with you, man.
I appreciate your help so much.
Will Vinton has been bringing clay to life for more than 15 years, but nothing before has attracted attention like the California raisins.
It just hit that cultural nerve when people became aware of this process of claymation, and they wanted to be part of it.
Michael, you know, we should do you as California raisin.
Yeah!
Will wanted this to feel like you were in his clay world.
Yeah.
Furniture was made out of clay, the walls were clay, the pictures on the wall were clay.
You would not believe what it felt like to walk through that place. It was like magic.
The studio was all over the media at the time. It was the shit.
We were rebels, we were in Portland, we were doing stop motion. We didn't have big money behind us, it was just like the little studio that could.
He really wanted to be the next Walt Disney.
And it looked as if maybe that were happening.
The winner is Close Mondays, Will Vinton and Bob Gardner.
Together, they were the perfect team. They really hit gold.
It's fantastic.
He just all of a sudden got to be super big and the animation icon.
We really scaled it up. $35 million revenue. 400 people.
I'm impressed.
Will's enthusiasm was the company's greatest asset and probably the greatest danger.
When people give you a lot of money, there are expectations. They get to call a lot of shots.
Thank you for turning me on.
Will started with just clay and a camera, and it just got out of hand.
It wouldn't be uncommon to get a phone call in the middle of the night, and it's Bob Gardner railing about Will.
He threatened to assassinate Will Vinton at the Rose Festival parade.
Things had gotten so strange there. By the time they were doing the PJs and Gary and Mike, I would say it was a completely different company.
Then the shows got canceled, and he was stuck with this big debt.
Kicked to the curb of his own company? How could he build all this up and then it gets taken away?
For him to lose his company and then not be able to use his name was just, like, horrifying.
It was just of a particular time, this beautiful little spot, and the people who got to be part of it were lucky to be part of it.
Everything I've done is a build, is something that I've built one thing on top of the other, and the next thing I do is informed by all of those other things. I love being able to feel like my life is continuum, that things that may have felt like they might have been missteps was not at all a misstep.
We were just listening to the audio for the trailer to Welcome to My Daydream, documentary on Will Vinton, a work in progress. Well, we'll leave the last word to Will, here talking about how to approach and what to expect from a workshop he was offering. Will Vinton.
The thing about claymation is that it's so immediate. As soon as you start messing with it, you get instant feedback, and for what it is that you're trying to do. Day one will be animating. Every day is going to be a lot of time in front of the camera, really working. Character animation in general, materials, use of materials, for sure story and so forth, and the basics of animation as well, stuff that you apply immediately to what it is that we're going to be doing, you're doing in the class that day. I think I really expect anyone who's taking this class to be at least engaged enough and motivated enough to just go for it. It's not like to do this kind of class, you have to have great, artistic skills necessarily, drawing and sculpting and that sort of thing. But you do really have to have a passion to make things happen and bring things to life and so on. And frankly, that's the real joy of learning this kind of animation is, kind of breathing life into it. It's so cool. It's so amazing to sort of have like a ball of clay that ultimately just kind of comes to life.
To learn more about the Will Vinton documentary, see our show page for links by visiting kboo.fm and searching for The Politics of Living and looking for Episode 9. Next up, The She-Ra Solution. It's a monthly biography of women past and present, hosted by Kristen Thiel. Its title is inspired by Maria Theresa Hart's article, She-Ra and the Fight Against the Token Girl, published in The Atlantic. And on today's segment, Kristen introduces us to another animator, filmmaker, and a young scientist.
This month, I bring you a tale of two extraordinary people working in two very different fields, in two very different parts of the world, from two different generations, but they share the exact same name, Gitanjali Rao. The elder Gitanjali was born in 1972 in Mumbai, India, where she continues to make her home. She attended Sir J.J. Institute of Applied Art, which is affiliated with the University of Mumbai. Her parents were architects, and they encouraged her to create things too, so such an education made sense. For more than 8 decades, this institution has held a top place in producing advertisers, but since Gitanjali wasn't interested in that, she took the skills they taught her and went into animation for adult audiences. Her short film, Printed Rainbow, was the first Indian animation film to be selected at the Cannes Film Festival. By winning 3 awards during the festival's Critics Week in 2006, including Best Short, it proved it deserved to be on that international stage. Between them, Gitanjali's films Orange and Printed Rainbow, both of which she produced and directed, have won 28 awards. Gitanjali has also served as a member of the jury at various film festivals, including the 2011 Cannes Critics Week. At the 2014 Critics Week, her animated short, True Love Story, was one of 10 selected short films. She spoke with The Hollywood Reporter about being a filmmaker, as a woman, as an Indian, and as an animator. She said that animation is much more balanced between women and men than other areas of filmmaking are. It's about 50-50, whereas live action or documentary sees about 8% women filmmakers. Animation, she said, is a very young industry, and the women working in this can define what they want to say. I have never felt it tough to work in this genre as a woman. That said, it can be a difficult field. Financing is always an issue for all filmmakers of animated movies, she said. Even though there's money in India, she's given up looking for the funding because producers constantly tell her they don't want to fund animation. And the situation is no better elsewhere. She worked on a project for Disney for a year and a half. It was a modern retelling of an Indian epic, aimed at kids but also appealing to adults. Everything was approved, she wrote the film, did pre-production design, and then it was pulled because, quote, the finances didn't work. Interestingly, her 2014 film, True Love Story, is about another area of movie making, Bollywood. Gitanjali says her movie casts Bollywood as the villain. It's seductive, especially to actors from poor backgrounds, and treacherous, she said, potentially crushing. The younger Gitanjali in our tale was born 34 years after the award-winning filmmaker and around the world from her. Last month, 11-year-old Gitanjali from Lone Tree, Colorado, made her mark as a scientist. She won the $25,000 grand prize in the 2017 Discovery Education 3M Young Scientist Challenge. That contest is for students in grades 5 through 8. Gitanjali was frustrated hearing the news about lead-poisoned water in Flint, Michigan. When she watched her parents test for lead in their home water, she saw firsthand how difficult or inaccessible home testing can be. She told Business Insider UK, quote, I went, well, this is not a reliable process, and I've got to do something to change this. She created a device to detect lead in water and then paired it with a Bluetooth app. She named it Tethys, after the Greek goddess of water. She thinks that with some modification, the device could be a huge help for people living anywhere lead contamination is a problem. People of color are disproportionately affected by lead toxicity, which attacks the brain and central nervous system, causing mental and physical issues, even death. Mexico, the Philippines, and India are among the worst affected in the world. In the States, cities like Flint, which is majority African American, have faced contamination issues. Also, research has shown that anemia, which is more common in communities of color, and particularly women, raises the body's rate of lead absorption. Gitanjali wants to be either a geneticist or an epidemiologist when she grows up. Lead contamination is interesting to her, she said, because it combines both disciplines. If history is any indicator, winning this Young Scientist Challenge may indeed launch Gitanjali toward her goal. The 2012 winner, Deepika Kurup, was another young female, also working in water purification. 3 years later, she was named to the Forbes 30 Under 30 list. She's now continuing her studies at Harvard. The name Gitanjali means a collection of poems or songs, a melodious tribute or offering. 45-year-old Gitanjali Rao, award-winning animator from India, and 11-year-old Gitanjali Rao, award-winning scientist from the United States, are not following their name's meaning in the literal sense, but what they're doing, changing our world for the better, is pure poetry. I'm your host, Kristen Thiel, and I'll be back next month.
That was Kristen Thiel with this month's The She-Ra Solution. To learn more about the women featured, check out the links on our show page by visiting kibu.fm, search for The Politics of Living, and look for Episode 9. Contributor Darka Dusty returns with a new segment for The Politics of Living called 10 Minutes with Darka. She'll be sharing interviews and music with a variety of guests, and this month she debuts with a conversation with Rachel Rice. Rachel is a full-time writer, artist, and educator who lives right here in Portland.
Hi, this is Darka Dusty, and I'm starting a new segment for The Politics of Living called
10 Minutes with Darka. And my first guest is someone who I just love listening to whenever she opens her mouth. We were together in the band called the Vulva Underground for a few years, and I just love everything she does and her artwork and her politics and her feminism and all of that. So I lured her into my little trap here today to talk to her about everything that's going on in the world, and we have 10 minutes to do it. So, Rachel Rice, welcome.
Hi, Darka. Thanks for having me. This is awesome. Let's do it all in 10 minutes.
It's just going to take 10 minutes to fix the world,
yep,
right?
Yep, not worried at one bit.
Well, I guess the first question I want to ask you about is what you make of the hashtag MeToo moment in social media last week that just exploded. And what is it that you were thinking of when you saw friend after friend and woman after woman and maybe even some men do that hashtag, and even some that talked about their experiences? What did that feel like as a feminist and as a woman who is raising two daughters right now?
Thank you. That's a good question. I think like a lot of people, it was actually kind of triggering. It was sort of like, just as someone that has experienced, you know, sexual violence, sexual assault and abuse at the hands of men, it was rough. It was rough to sort of see this spooling out of, personal narrative. And I did have a bit of a trauma response. Like, I kind of had to take a time out from social media. It was really, it was pretty painful for me. And I also think it's sort of a necessary piece of, you know, this grand reckoning that I think we're all living through right now, where a lot of veils are dropping and a lot of things that have hidden are now being brought to light. So all in all, I say thumbs up.
And what are some of those veils? Or it's just maybe another way of saying, what are we hiding in society? And what is women's role in the fixing of it?
Yeah, well, that's hard to say in under 10 minutes, but it does seem that there are a lot of like systems of domination that have kind of flown under the radar that are now sort of being very much, you know, brought into light and questioned really openly. There's a lot of stuff that I think we all kind of, and I say we all, I'm speaking for, you know, like white kind of cisgendered, you know, mainstream folks that don't live, that aren't as marginalized, although women, you know, are in lots of ways. But that, you know, we have Nazis marching freely in the streets and we're kind of going, wow, how did we get here? And then there's a lot of other folks that are like, yeah, we've been seeing this for a while and y'all are just now sort of waking up to it. So I think there's some waking up that's happening. And as we wake up, you know, we know better. As you say, you know, as we know better, we do better.
Yeah. No, exactly. And so you touched upon this just a minute ago, and I want to ask you, because you do a lot of racial justice activism, and I want to ask you, point blank, what is it that white people can do to stop being part of the problem that we have in this society right now?
I think that's going to be a hard one, because I'm not sure that we can stop being a problem until we really understand what whiteness means, how it moves, and really composting it. We need to decommission whiteness. And that means really looking hard at what whiteness is, as a social construct, but also as an embodied kind of privilege and way that we move through the world that inherently is oppressive, just by virtue of the fact that we have white skin. And so we collude with this system of domination. You can't really change your skin color and then be exempt, like we see Rachel Dolezal. That's not gonna work. So we're gonna have to dig a little bit deeper, and I think we're gonna have to be with the grief of the fact that we don't have any perfect answers right now. We have to let it fall apart, and we have to have a seat and let people that are affected by whiteness tell us how it is and actually listen to what they might need. And that would be a really good starting place.
That's an interesting one. I'm going to make sure to follow up on that with you, maybe start some kind of discussion group.
Sure.
So This is all political.
Hey, wait,
this,
one thing. It just occurred to me. One thing we can all do is if you just watch The Office and see how Michael Scott behaves and do the exact opposite of that, you'll start to compost whiteness, I think. There's just a doable. There's a small doable there.
Yeah, that's a good one. So just in a broader sense of the dangerous climate that we're in right now with this very, very... sort of Wild West government that we have right now. What can we do to offset all the policies, the dangerous executive orders, and specifically the attitudes that are coming from the top down? What can we do as citizens to try to offset that? Because it can get very exhausting to be just a reader of the news if you are if you're a progressive-minded person.
Well, I probably would say for me, I'm not really progressive or liberal. I would say I'm pretty radical. So I'm not really interested in reforming the state to make it into something that feels good, or that I'm much more of a sort of a bio-regional anarchist, maybe, if I had to.
I'll have to look that up.
I might have just made that up. But like, I think one of the solutions that we can do is to be really local, be like Martin Shaw says, be famous for a 5-mile radius. Because what we're talking about is the breakdown of social cohesion, and I think we're going to need to root really locally to make that social cohesion be part of our everyday lives and not locate our liberation in the state. I think it's going to be with each other.
Oh, that's beautifully put. Well, you know, I know you do a lot of this kind of thinking, and as a woman, right now, your role has changed because in the last few years, you have taken on the role of mother. And now that that's happened to you, what is it that you want to say about women's labor and how much we take on in our lives?
I think that this whole piece about emotional labor that is coming into the cultural vernacular is really, really helpful. It's helped me with my partner kind of explain what we need to sort of re-examine what it means to be a working person. There's a lot of labor that typically women, femmes, and female-bodied folks perform that is unpaid, and that looks like, you know, caregiving, it looks like listening, it looks like, you know, being emotionally present for the family, processing thoughts and feelings out loud, attaching words to feelings and being able to express them, not to mention all the housework and all of the, day-to-day stuff that women do that we sort of consider being something that maybe just housewives do, but it's actually labor. It actually should be paid. And emotional labor is labor, and it's typically disproportionately located with women and femmes. And it's something that men, it's very hard to sort of, it's kind of like unpacking whiteness, you know, it's hard to see it when you live it so much.
Right.
And so it's hard to explain sometimes and then while you're explaining it, you're doing the emotional labor of explaining it, you know?
Yeah.
So the articles that are going around and stuff, and even like the invoices that I've, like the sort of fake invoices for emotional labor that I've been seeing are like pretty, I think, you know, kind of provocative art statements and educational resources. And I would encourage people to just, you know, check Google emotional labor, you know, and have
a emotional labor.
Yeah, have a conversation with your partner about it. It's work. It's actual work. And we need to do better with our men and boys so that they know what emotional labor looks like and also how to perform it.
I would like to say that in that hashtag Me Too moment in social media last week, I was pretty astounded with how many men spoke up, and not just because they might have been sexually assaulted or overpowered or whatever. They actually came out as someone who has been the abuser.
Yes, I saw that.
And that was pretty incredible because they basically went on this public forum to ask for forgiveness. And I think that's a very important kind of emotional labor to know just how much you're, weighing down the opposite sex with your power plays and the things that you do.
Yes.
It's really not about sex, is it?
It's about power.
Often
and that's why patriarchy, screws us all.
Yep.
Men too. Yeah.
And what is it to you to be a feminist? We have like less than a minute. What does the word feminist mean to you?
Well, this is interesting because I just got into this really kind of interesting round and round on the internet about this product called Feminist Marketing School. And I tagged into a bunch of discussions about it. And I was just like, you know what? That's actually not a thing.
Yeah.
You know, feminist marketing doesn't really work because I think we need to... My understanding of feminism is really understanding that who I am is not actually separate from the land that I'm on. That I am actually, I am not just a person, I'm a place. I am what's called a holon or a holobiont, which is an aggregate of all kinds of communities that live, whether they're bacterial or little critters that live in my eyelashes, but that I'm not just a person that can extract resources from the earth. I'm actually part of the earth, and that we are co-creating this earth together, that we are just a part of the place that is the place that is us.
Wow.
And so internalizing that and really penetrating that deeply that's actually what feminism means to me at its core, apart from the political stuff, which, you know, I don't think we need to go too much into because people, you know, are kind of hip to that. But
hey, listen. So the weird noises that you've been hearing is not me breathing hard because Rachel's so smart and I love listening to her. It's actually my dog, Lulu. Who is it, Lulu? Hello, Lulu.
Yeah, baby.
So thanks, everybody, for listening. This is my friend Rachel Rice, and you can see more. Actually, you can hear more of what Rachel has to say. She writes amazing stuff and thoughtful, provocative pieces. You can read them at rachelrice.com. And we'll see you next time for 10 Minutes with Darka.
Thanks, Darka.
Next up, I'd like to share a bit of a personal story with you. This past summer, my sister died, and it brought up a lot of thoughts around living, relationship, and navigating life's big holes. There's nothing like a death to shake things up, and the dance that ensues between the guilt and the relief can be exhausting. My sister Jenny died in the quiet early morning hours of June 18th, 2017. It's only been a few months since her passing, but it feels like a lifetime has passed, and in a sense one has. I keep thinking, how could this have happened? Although the two of us were so far away from being close, we were still family. Now I wonder about the mothering her two daughters will now need. Jenny struggled in her early years. Our mother lacked healthy parenting skills, and coupled with an undiagnosed mental illness, she couldn't be the mother that any of us needed, let alone for her youngest child, who started to struggle with her own mental health issues. I have vague memories of that tumultuous time when our mom pretty much stopped parenting any of us. I was almost an adult, but Jenny was just entering her teens. All of us kids were figuring out ways to make it to the other side. And although we joined together to navigate surviving our mom's second abusive marriage, we were now splintered, entering our own worlds of figuring things out on the eve of our individual adulthood. Jenny was left alone. I sit and think about that sentence and feel the acute heaviness in my heart because I know it to be true. She shared as much in her book, Crooked Tales, The Short Stories. She wrote her first and only book and published it in 2015. It took me until her death to purchase and start reading it. In it, her loneliness fills so many pages. We were so different from one another, and with a 5-year age gap, that felt more like decades. We had different fathers. We looked different from one another. We had different temperaments. The only thing we had in common was living in a dysfunctional home, riddled with so much lack and poverty and laced with abuse. I have very little recollection of those early days, as they long been buried under years of weathering later in life wars. My own inward focus on trying to figure out who I was to be in the world continues currently in my present day. So many layers. I left the house. Well, actually, I was kicked out of the house because I was the only working adult in the household and refused to continue underwriting everyone's financial needs. It was the best thing that could have happened at the time, but not without the emotional bruises to carry with me. I became even more disconnected from my siblings as I tried to figure out where to land. One of those pursuits was getting married very young. My mother and I had a falling out a couple of weeks before that wedding, and all of my siblings were forbidden to attend. Later, Jenny and I reconnected when she became a mother. I was freshly divorced and hell-bent on adding more of those, quote, layers to keep me as distant from the real stuff of being. Admittedly, the last thing on my mind was how to be a supportive older sister to Jenny, as she was a teen mom when she had her first child. Eventually, I made a life that was not only physically distant, but emotionally miles away by moving from Pennsylvania to Oregon. And I didn't keep in touch with my siblings very much. My brother Michael continued to battle his own mental health demons, and I lost track of him. I loosely kept in touch with Jenny and my other brother Steve, but that was only when I went back east to visit. Our mom died unexpectedly on February 12, 2002, 2 weeks shy of her 59th birthday. I came to discover a few years after her passing that she battled her mental health demons around bulimia. For years, that disease destroyed her body and spirit until she couldn't take it any longer. A cold stumbled into pneumonia, and that beast took her in a matter of days. I flew home within days of her passing, and a beautiful thing happened. Our family united to support one another emotionally. All that crap in our collective history disappeared as we mourned the loss of the only mother we knew. 4 years later, we once again rallied to one another's side when our brother Michael died from an overdose. I was once baffled that we had the capacity to be there for one another. But while writing this reflection, it occurred to me that we had good practice in our early childhood, dealing with poverty and abuse. We knew how to hold each other up because we learned how to do that so early in our lives. In subsequent years, I kept in touch with Jenny. And when I came to visit on another occasion, she had become a mom for a second time. And things seemed to be settling down for her. Once Facebook came into all of our lives, that's how we kept up to date with each other, albeit sporadically. Recently, I came across a thread of connection I had with Jenny on Facebook, and it was heartbreaking and illuminating. A total reframing of what I recall we spoke about or wrote about. I clearly had blinders on when it came to my sister, and as I read those exchanges, as I also read her book, I paused and asked her to forgive me for not knowing, not realizing that what she was sharing with me was truly who she was. Not the intense pose that she was sharing on social media. Had I paid more attention, well, who knows what could have come of that conversation with her, but I learned something deep and meaningful about Jenny in those moments. She was heartbreakingly alone and yet was doing everything she could to remain connected to the world she lived in. Her daughters and later her grandkids were her saving grace in so many ways. She could love them as fiercely as she wanted to, and nothing could take that away, not even the cancer that killed her. We have yet another new segment to share with you today, a Vox Pop by our very own Liam Delta. He recently went to downtown Portland to ask folks what they've been doing to keep sane, if you will, in this wild world that we live in.
I look for the good in people. I think our leaders are completely messed up, but the people on the street are okay. And we need to band together and look out for ourselves.
Smoke a lot of pot.
I drink a lot.
You stay away from churches, number one. Oh, no. You stay away from that. And you don't do drugs and things like that. Booze, you don't do that. Keep your head clear.
I travel. That's what I do. My wife and I are from Atlanta, Georgia, and this is what we're doing.
I don't even know, man. Just try to work out, I guess. Work out and eat right. That's about it. Everything else is clutter.
I sail boats. Buy a boat, give up everything else, and live on it and sail. I am doing that right now.
I live my life myself and let everybody else find their own happiness.
I read a lot and I drink wine.
We're just holding on to the scriptures. We read Bible and that's what guides us in this crazy world.
Obey my parents.
I spend time with friends and other people that are kind of going through similar feelings that I'm going through, and we kind of just talk it out and do direct action, as in like attending protests, as well as just taking care of our bodies and our minds and just spending time in community.
I don't, like, I'm not okay. I'm figuring it out. I think community is key.
Man, I don't do nothing. I don't read the news, I don't watch TV. I just hang out, sit.
I don't know. Drink lots of Pepsi? Stay home?
I drink a lot.
Oh, I can't say on radio.
Smoke a lot of cigarettes, honestly. It's true.
I don't stay sane.
I just keep a optimistic attitude. Because world is about the easiest we've had it ever. In the history of modern man in this world. At least it is up here in Portland, it is.
I already have enough crazy, insane stuff happening now. It's actually really difficult. Yoga, talking with friends, therapy, self-care. Self-care is very important.
I have hope and faith in Jesus.
I run like about four miles a day and then longer on the weekends. Starts my day off right, and I can just have energy to get through the day and helps me just de-stress and stay positive as much as possible anyway.
Make money.
Distract myself by staying busy, going places, being a parent.
Just look at the water.
I don't think I do. I do a lot of dance. That's probably the biggest help, yeah.
I do art and writing. Mostly poetry, sort of an emotional dumping ground.
Be myself. I'm crazy myself. I go out picking up bottles and cans. Basically, stay away from the real nutty people out here.
Pray to God, drink lots of coffee. I eat my beef jerky.
Drink.
I spend time being quiet and I think about God. I process through what I'm going through by being quiet. I try and keep myself quiet and focused. I try and stay away from other people right now so that I can get focused because there's a lot of drama and I don't need to be any more confused. Right now I open up the Bible and I read it and I want to see what it says. I want to have an understanding for who God is.
You have to, first of all, look towards God.
Well, I try to do the best I can.
Well, I have a daughter who helps me laugh. I play music with friends and on my own. And not infrequently, I get high.
Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of The Politics of Living. Thanks to our guests, as well as our contributors, Kristen Thiel, Anessa Anderson, Darka Dusty, and Liam Delta. Also thanks to our technical editor, Liam Delta, and web manager, Vicky Mazzone. Thanks so much for listening to The Politics of Living. I'm Denise Kowalczyk. Have a great day.
It's 10 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up at 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock, The Bike Show brings you news and views of cycling in Oregon and beyond. But to take us up to 10:15, we've got Air Cascadia coming right up after this announcement. It's KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements